Hello, friends. It's your old pal Ariel Helwani on this Wednesday, June 19th, 2019. Welcome to a brand new episode of the MMA Reporters right here on ESPN. All platforms. We're on all platforms. We're killing it. Fastest growing podcast in the history of the worldwide leader. That's what I'm told. Smashing it. Thanks to you. Thanks to your downloads and reviews and ratings and all those things and more. So please keep it up. We love you for it. We appreciate it. I'm excited about today's show because we've got a lot to talk about with a lot of interesting people. Later in the program, we'll be joined by my pal New York Rick. He was with me in New York for Bellator's second Madison Square Garden show. We'll also be joined by Mark Raimondi of ESPN. Talk about some news and notes. No UFC last weekend, but of course UFC is back this weekend. They had a rare bye week, but it usually never lasts more than a week. And so now we are back on Saturday for their debut in beautiful Greenville, South Carolina. Unfortunately, this card isn't headlined by Wonderboy Thompson. It was supposed to be headlined by him, but he got knocked out by Anthony Pettis and just wasn't healthy enough to take a fight. He is from nearby Simpsonville, has a school very close to Greenville as well. I know he's doing media, he'll be there, but it would have been a layup to have him on the card. Unfortunately, that is not the case. So the main event is Chan Sung Jung versus Renato Moicano. And it's interesting because it's two fighters coming off losses and high-profile losses. You'll recall Chan Sung Jung lost to Yair Rodriguez in the final seconds of their fight back in November. 25th anniversary show ended up being, in many people's eyes, the knockout of the year. And so this is his first fight since. And Renato Moicano lost to Jose Aldo back in February in a fight that was sort of supposed to be his coming out party. So here you have two fighters coming off losses in a main event. Rare. Doesn't usually happen this way, but an important fight for both of them. I'm really looking forward to the Matt Wyman fight against Luis Pena because we haven't seen Matt Wyman in 5 years. And I've been trying to talk to him, but he just doesn't want to talk to anyone. And so I'm just curious to see how he looks and what he says, if anything, in the build-up to this fight and afterwards. And there are some other interesting fights. Lipsky McCann, the debut of Daron Wynn. And so something for everyone. Of course, Bellator in London on Saturday as well. The fun never stops. And we had yesterday the first episode of Dana White's Contender Series. It made its debut on ESPN Plus from the brand new UFC Apex in Las Vegas. They're calling it the UFC Apex, which is an interesting name, a very memorable name. And it looked, by all indications, like a state-of-the-art facility. And so this is going to be the home of this show, Contender Series, perhaps some boxing events, maybe when they bring back Tough or some variation of it. So they're doing a lot with it. Post shows, they're going to do their pre-shows, all that and more. For more on the debut of Contender Series, let us say hello to my fellow Canadian, the MMA reporter for TSN, the one and only Aaron Bronstetter is kind enough to join us. Aaron, how are you?
Ariel, I'm great. Yourself?
I'm really great. Wow, you came out hot there. You're excited to be here, Aaron.
I haven't talked MMA in a couple days, so I'm rearing and ready to go.
Okay, you're revved and ready to go, as Dana White once said. His first ever appearance on a UFC broadcast like 17 years ago, he said, I'm revved and ready to go. And so you remind me of Dana. And that's a good segue to yesterday's action in Las Vegas. It's good. There's good and bad here, Aaron, because if you're a positive person, you'll say, look, on a Wednesday, on a random Wednesday, the biggest story in MMA right now is Contender Series. And then if you're a negative Nancy, you'll say, well, people are criticizing it. It's controversial. I tend to think in this particular case, it's good for the brand, it's good for everyone involved, but I do think it's worth talking about, and we're talking about the controversy right off the top. The controversy is that Brendan Loughnane, a veteran of the game who so desperately wants to be a part of the UFC, did not get a contract despite his win over Bill Algeo, and two other fighters got contracts, Puna Soriano and Jurgen De Castro. And anyway, he got the finish, and Puna did not get the finish, and everyone's harping now on Loughnane not getting the contract. What did you make of Dana White's decision to not give locked in a contract and also his reasoning behind it.
Is there a controversy? I mean, did people forget how the show operates? Is this their first time watching it?
I don't know if you're being facetious or not right now.
No, I'm not being facetious at all. Because what we've seen in the past is that matchups don't matter, weight classes don't matter, attitude matters. The UFC, and particularly Dana White, because he's the one who's doling out these contracts with the, I'm sure some input from his matchmakers, is looking for aggressive individuals who finish fights or try to finish fights. Who they're against is secondary. What weight class they're in is secondary. He's looking for a specific mindset, a specific aggression, and when he sees that, that's who he gravitates towards. So regardless of what the level of competition is, what the level of competitor is, that's what this reality show, so to speak, that's the mandate, and that's what people have to do in order to get a contract on the show. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. As soon as Lockname won that fight, I was on Twitter and said it's unlikely he gets a contract. Now, with only four fights, it was more likely than on a different episode that would have had five fights for him to get a contract. But we need to remember here that what Dana White is looking for is somebody that's trying to go for the kill or somebody who is able to get a finish in whatever first, second, third round. And that only happened in one fight. And the only other fighter that showed the aggression that was close to finishing a fight was Soriano. So I wasn't surprised that that's who the contracts went to. Before Dana White decided who the contracts were going to go to, that's who I said they would go to. And it is on brand for this particular show and the mandate of the show that's how it went.
So you think that Soriano's performance warranted a contract over Lockname's?
I do, based on what the criteria of the show is and has been in the past.
Okay, and so this idea that the guy, Lockname, didn't get a contract because he went for a takedown in the final 10 seconds, that's the only reason why? Had he stood there and traded and went for broke, so to speak, that he would have gone on contract. Even if he didn't knock him out, he would have gone on contract. Like, see, my issue with it, Aaron, is that they are phrasing this or framing it like the fact that he went for a takedown with 10 seconds left. We're not talking about a minute left. We're not talking about 90 seconds left. We're talking about 10 seconds left in a fight, which, you know, he was left bloodied and bruised afterwards. He was urinating blood. He showed that on Instagram. 10 seconds, you're going to punish the guy and not give him a contract? You're going to view that as some sort of escape, like he was weak and just tried to look for the easy route? Isn't that a little funny? At the end of the day, I get what the criteria of the show is, wherever, you know, I don't know where that's written. I don't know where that's actually said. But this is a mixed martial arts fight. Like, you should not be punished for doing something that's well within the rules and something that's a part of the actual, you know, sport.
Well, it's not written anywhere, but it's what we've seen for the past two seasons, as well as the Brazilian season. So, again, I'm not saying that it's fair that he didn't get the contract. I'm saying that it's fair within the parameters of what we've seen from the show in the past that it makes sense that he didn't get one. Because, as I mentioned, it doesn't matter how high level you are. It doesn't matter how high level your opponent is. None of this stuff is ever taken into consideration, which is a massive flaw in this particular show and the way that it's handled and the way these contracts are doled out. However, that is how we have seen things play out in the past. So when a contract is not given out to Lockname because he went for a takedown or because he wasn't super aggressive or wasn't going for a finish for the entire fight, wasn't going, you know, balls to the wall, as they say, that is on par with what we've seen in the past from this show, and that's why I thought Soriano was going to get the contract, because Soriano, at the end of that first round, was pushing the pace, was hitting Pickett, nearly got him out of there. Pickett basically fled at the end of the round so that he wouldn't get hit, which is, of course, a smart strategic move. I'm not saying the guy's a runner or anything like that. When there's 10 seconds left in a round, if you can get out of that round and give yourself a fresh breath of air, that's the right thing to do. But I saw that we saw Soriano go for the kill. He did tire out towards the end of the second round and then reverted to his wrestling, which he was able to. I mean, if you want to talk about a dominant performance, there wasn't a single strike landed on him in the third round. Pickett was completely neutralized for that entire third round. So based on what I saw and based on what the criteria of the show is, I would put Soriano's performance above Lockname in the scope of what Dana White is looking for when he's giving out contracts.
So this is akin to like a controversial judging decision, and you say like, all right, well, we know that judges don't know what they're looking for, so I can predict that they're going to, you know, score this a split decision or disagree on one guy or the other. Well, the question I'm asking you is, do you agree with the decision? Not do you understand why Dana did it, because this is what he has told us the show is all about. If you were Dana White and you were judging talent and you're in charge of this show, are you not signing Brandon Lockname because he went for a takedown with 10 seconds left? Can you justify the decision?
Well, again, are you putting me into Dana's mind?
This is the question. This is why it's controversial, because I think...
You're putting me into Dana's mind, and I'm looking at it from that particular criteria that's been established on the show
before. Come on.
Okay.
What's been established?
Well, listen,
it doesn't say, they don't say at the beginning of the show. They don't say at the beginning of the show that you have to finish someone to get a contract. Go ahead.
It's not stated, but that's been what has happened in the past seasons. Now, I think that Lochnane, based on who he fought, the caliber of fighter, and how he performed, definitely deserves a contract. It was a one-sided decision in the closest fight on paper going into the event. I thought DeCastro, if I had one contract to give, I'd give it to DeCastro over all of them because of how he was able to neutralize the biggest favorite on the card, get a finish in the first round. That, I think, is a no-brainer. But if you're giving out two contracts, and, of course, it's all up to Dana, and, you know, it's at his discretion. He could have given out four contracts yesterday if he wanted to. But, again, based on what we've seen in the past, I think that the performance of Soriano is more, you know, on brand with what Dana White has been looking for in past seasons of the show. And I don't think people should have been that surprised that Lochnane didn't get a contract if they've watched the show religiously since its inception.
So again, and you nailed it, it's all up to him. This is his show. It's sort of positioned as, I mean, it really is kind of positioned as like 17th century gladiator stuff where they show, you know, shots of him giving the thumbs up, thumbs down. It's not 100% like that, but for all intents and purposes, it's him. I mean, at this point, it's like all on him. We're not even talking about Sean Shelby and McMaynor. McMaynor wasn't even there for this show. He was in China, for the opening of the Performance Institute. My issue is, so you can't begrudge someone who's making a personal decision. It's his private company. He can do whatever he wants. My issue is the reasoning. Given. Like, if you say, look, I just didn't think it was a good fight. I wasn't impressed with them. I don't think there's a future. Fine. But if we're going to pin it all on the fact that the guy went for a takedown with 10 seconds left in the fight, 10 seconds. And earlier today, I was talking to Gilbert Melendez for Ari on the Bad Guy. Chael's not there, so Gilbert stepped in. And he was like, look, when I fought Diego Sanchez, I went for broke in the last 10 seconds. When Max Holloway fought Ricardo Lamas, he pointed to the middle of the cage and went for broke. Great examples. But let's be honest, not apples to apples. In this particular case, Brendan is fighting for his career. He is trying to get – no one has ever gotten a contract off of a loss on Dana White Contender Series. So he's trying to get the W first. And at this point, 10 seconds left, he's not going to get the finish. He's not going to knock him out. I mean, the fight was pretty much wrapped up. And so to put this on the guy and say, like, this poor kid, say, like, because you went for a takedown with 10 seconds left, you're not good enough to be in the UFC. When, let's be honest, like, what does UFC caliber even mean anymore? Greg Hardy, CM Punk. You're telling me Brendan Lochnane doesn't deserve to be in there? Plus, a marketable guy who has Tyson Fury behind him, all these people. He's got a great story. I just don't like the reasoning. Do you understand what I'm saying? I don't like the way it was pinned. I want killers. What does that mean? What does that mean, you want killers? Like, what did Brendan not do that Puna did? And so the whole thing just was a little hard to digest because this is mixed martial arts. And if you're going to tell people you want finishes, then just say you want a finish. And if you don't get a finish, you're probably not going to get chosen. But they don't say that, to the best of my knowledge. Maybe I missed it.
Well, ultimately, again, this isn't the Ariel Helwani Contender Series, the Aaron Bronstetter Contender Series. This is the Dana White Contender Series. We know what Dana's looking for. We've seen this over the years, that Dana wants people that are going for finishes, that are being ultra-aggressive and trying to get that finish for all three rounds or as often as possible. And I thought that, again, one thing that's completely overlooked here is that Algio was the best opponent that anybody had on the card in terms of, you know, how high caliber he was. No disrespect to the others that competed on this show, but in terms of the runner-up in all four of these fights, Algio was by far the most competitive, and we knew that going in. If you looked at the odds going into the event, I think that was the closest lined fight, that or the fight between Robbins and Goldie, but it was in the same area code. So that kind of thing, and even in Goldie's case, Goldie looked very good, I thought. I do understand that she was moving backwards a lot, and that's not what Dana White's looking for, but she did look good. She looked like she has some great skills, but you need to frame it in the mind of what Dana White is looking for in these particular shows. He's made that very clear, and that's why when Lochnane didn't get a contract, it didn't surprise me. Now, when you look at the fact that, according to reports, the UFC is going to Manchester in August, and this individual happens to be from Manchester, it certainly would make a lot of sense to have him on that card.
100%. Yeah, even more so. You know, it's kind of interesting. I wonder if they're going to do it. Bellator's in London this weekend, and they're making a huge push in the UK market. We had John Kavanaugh on my show Monday, and he's doing his own show, and the winner of that show is going to get a Bellator contract. Bellator is trying to really make a push in that market. I wonder if I'm Scott Coker or Mike Hogan, do I Do I fly Brendan Loughnane out to London and have him sit in the front row? That would create some buzz, right?
Sure, but that's something that the UFC needs to realize is going to be the risk of them not signing a particular fighter, because they remain free agents. They can sign wherever they please, unless there's some sort of language in the contract that forbids them from signing somewhere within whatever 3 months, 90 days, whatever, something along those lines. I don't know if that language is in the contract because I've never seen it. But we've seen this in the past. We see Chris Curtis is in the PFL now. We see Austin Vanderford is in Bellator now. If the UFC passes on somebody, then they're going to have to live with their decision.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying...
Oh, no, 100%. I understand. I totally understand what you're saying, and that it would make a lot of sense for Bellator to do that. I know that Loughnane has been very fixated on being in the UFC, but maybe this situation is going to be something that turns him off of it, because he felt like he had done everything that he could. It was, again, the most competitive fight on the card. It was back and forth. Algio represented himself well, even though he didn't win a round on the scorecards. I thought he looked really good, particularly in the second round. But at the end of the day, again, if you're going with the criteria with what we've seen in the past, this should not be viewed as a controversial decision.
Nah, I don't know about that. Show me this criteria. Austin Vanderford didn't get selected.
Watch the show, Ariel.
And he got a finish.
Watch the previous two seasons. Go back and watch.
What? Go back and watch. So why didn't Austin Vanderford get a contract?
Go back and watch who's been passed over in the past.
Okay, so then if that's the criteria, then I think Puna shouldn't have got a contract as well, because he went the distance. What's the difference?
Well, understandable. I mean, and Dana White kind of outlined what the difference was. I was actually surprised with when Dana opened up and was giving out the contracts that he did end up giving one to Puna, because it looked like he was going to try to make a statement.
Yeah.
But he did by saying that Puna went for the kill in the first round and was trying to get that finish,
subjective.
Whereas he didn't feel that Loughnane was trying to get the finish. That was kind of how he differentiated between the two.
The message would be a lot clearer if they just went with the guy who got the finish. Then I would say, all right, look, it's very clear they want finishes. But they chose a guy who didn't get a finish, and in my opinion, the fight wasn't as exciting as the Loughnane fight, and that's why I'm confused. I also, to me, it's just like, this is a sport that is so complex and so exciting because there's just a lot going on, right? I mean, you can win via many different avenues. And so to make it seem like going for a takedown is somehow a bad thing or somehow a detriment to your chances, I don't feel like is the best way to present the sport. You get what I'm saying?
Oh, 100%. And I think that it's certainly interesting in that viewpoint. So let's say Kyle Snyder was on the show. And he was on Contender Series, and he took someone down, manhandled them for three straight rounds, wrestled them, completely outclassed them. Maybe he doesn't get a contract. And we're talking about a guy that I consider to be, even though he's not really trying to have an MMA career, would be the biggest prospect on the planet if he delved into MMA. And he would get passed over as a result of that. So there are certainly flaws to this whole system of how they're bringing in talent from this particular show.
And so if you're a wrestler or someone that has a style like that, you're probably better off going like the LFA route, trying to win a title there or something, and just getting signed by the UFC. Because if you try to go the Contender Series route, you're going to be subjected to all of this nonsense, right? Like maybe if you're just a striker, it's best to go Contender Series. Maybe if you're a wrestler, it's not, because in this particular case, like you're actually being penalized for using wrestling.
Yeah, but I mean, we know how the matchmakers can operate sometimes. And let's say you turn down the opportunity to be on the Contender Series because you don't believe in, the stylistic fashion in which they're, forming a criteria to select a fighter. You could get penalized for that as well. So if you're trying to get to the show, you have to kind of abide by their rules. That's just the way it's been.
Yeah, I just, the last thing I'll say on this is like this idea that, you're not good enough to be in the UFC if you don't get this contract or anything like that. Like, UFC caliber means a very different thing in this day and age than it did maybe 10 years ago. Brendan Loughnane, in my opinion, is a UFC caliber fighter for whatever that means. In my opinion, he's good enough to be in the UFC and to get wins in the UFC, and I think he proved that last night. It's unfortunate that it has come to this, but I think if anyone is taking a step back and not taking this criticism personally as they shouldn't, they would recognize that this is probably good for the show. Being polarizing isn't a bad thing. It's not like we're saying the format doesn't work or anything like that. It's controversial when you have one guy deciding whether or not someone's going to get a contract or not. The one thing that I would like to see modified a little bit, if I may, is just like I like the idea that, these guys are sort of fighting for their futures and things like that. I have no problem. It's very unique. I've said that this show is more interesting than The Ultimate Fighter. I'm happy that The Ultimate Fighter has evolved into this. The shot of them bruised and bloodied and like just kind of sitting there and waiting and listening to Dana's critique and listening to whether or not they're going to make it, it's kind of hard to watch for me. Like, I get it. It's like something that you see in the in American Idol, these shows like that. But in those shows, like, you're not fighting for 15 minutes and you're not pouring everything out there and getting injured and having to urinate blood afterwards and all that stuff. It's hard to see these men and women have their dreams crushed after they were just in a 15-minute fight, as opposed to being on stage and singing and telling jokes or doing, like, you know, juggling act or something like that. You get what I'm saying?
People are making a lot of this video of Ben and Lochnane urinating blood, but, and I really don't want to come off as disrespect, but if every fighter that was peeing blood after a fight posted a video on Instagram, I think you'd probably be surprised at the percentage of fighters that pee blood after a fight.
Well, they aren't posting it, first and foremost, and second of all, I think it's because I think he felt the need to do that because he's essentially being told you're not good enough to be in the UFC.
Yeah, I agree. I understand the motive for it. And
well, you didn't do enough. You didn't go for broke. You're not a killer. You didn't do enough. You didn't go for broke. I mean, what do you mean you didn't do enough? The guy's peeing blood.
Yeah, I agree with you. But again, I'm sure that there have been a lot of others that have been on the show that haven't gotten contracts that probably were also peeing blood afterwards. I'm not trying to undermine Brendan Lochnane's video. And Dana White did say he thinks that Lochnane is good enough to be in the UFC, and we will see him in the UFC one day. But I agree with you. I mean, it's gut-wrenching. It's gut-wrenching to see these individuals. I mean, Lochnane, of the four fighters, certainly had the most wear and tear after the fight because of how back and forth it was. And again, the bigger issue that I have is that the level of competition that each person's facing is never a consideration. So when you see, like, let's say Alton Meeks ran through DeCastro and Alton Meeks is a 7-1 favorite. Let's say he knocks him out in two minutes. Nobody's going to say, well, this guy knocked out a fighter that wasn't as good as him, you know, based on these odds. People don't look at that. People don't look at the caliber of each fighter and take that into consideration. It's just how they perform that night against that particular opponent and how they finish the fight or don't finish the fight. So I think that's a pretty big loophole, because you could have two fighters that are absolutely UFC caliber. Both of them are really good. I mean, for example, Mike Davis lost by decision to, I think it was to Sadiq Youssef, if I recall,
yeah.
In a previous season. And that was kind of taken into consideration, I think, because Mike Davis is a really, really good prospect. He's in the UFC now, and people knew that he was a really good prospect. And I think that might have been taken into consideration when Youssef won the decision. But I think that most of the time it's not. Most of the time, when Dana White's making a decision, he's not taking into consideration just how close two fighters might be versus how much of a chasm there might be in talent between two individuals. So that's kind of a flaw in the show. But again, I think that Dana White kind of acts arbitrarily. It's the Dana White Contender Series, and Dana White can make that decision. And based on what we've seen in previous seasons, we know what he gravitates towards.
Okay, final question. Let me just ask you this, point blank. Not if I were Dana White, would I have given the contract. If you were the man in charge, you're there, Dana White turns to you and says, should I give this man a contract? Would you have given Brendan Lochnane a contract?
Yeah, I'd give all of them a contract.
No, that's not the question. That's not the question. That's a cop-out.
Okay, how about this?
Yes.
The question is, you have two contracts to give out, Aaron.
That's not
the
question. That's not the question either. Should
But then your question's flawed then.
Why? I want to know just
because
him.
I give all of them contracts. They're all warriors. They're all fantastic what they do. They're all like fantastic athletes.
So you're saying that you disagree with the decision?
Like, sure, I disagree with the decision not to give someone a contract. Absolutely, but again,
I'm not saying everyone in the world deserves a contract. I'm saying, did he do enough in that fight to impress you to the point where you think that he deserves a contract? He should be in the UFC.
Absolutely, and so did Goldie. So it's not just Brendan Lochnane. I think that Goldie made it, you know, at 115, if you look at the finish rate at 115, I think if you look at the amount of knockouts there have been at 115, I think Andrade might have the only one where she's had like a one-punch knockout at 115. Getting a finish at 115 is extremely difficult. So that's not being taken into consideration either. You know, when you look at the lighter weight classes, even when you look at Lochnane's weight class at 145, the finishing rate is lower there than it is at 185 where Puna Soriano fights. So that's not taken into consideration at all. And I think that's, again, a flaw in the show and a flaw in the format of the show. And that's why I would prefer if they had four 115ers, you know, four strawweight or five strawweight fights on a card, and they did it by weight class. I think that would the meritocracy would be a lot better there, because let's say it was five 145ers on that show, and Lochner's one of them. Maybe he has a better chance of getting a contract, because you don't have a heavyweight on that show that's more likely to get a finish, because the finishing rate is so much higher in that division.
That's a good point. I like that point. Great stuff, Aaron. I appreciate the passion. I appreciate the insight. Thank you for joining us.
No problem, Ariel. My pleasure.
All right, there he is. Aaron Bronstetter of TSN hosts their own MMA show, their own MMA show podcast over there with the great Joe Valtellini. Does a great job covering the sport north of the border. Now let's actually keep this conversation rolling along. But before I do that, let me tell you about my good friends over at the Cheap Heat podcast, Peter Rosenberg and crew. They do a great job. And I know my next guest is a huge fan of the podcast as well. It is called Cheap Heat. It's the go-to podcast for professional wrestling fans. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. When you give it a listen, please subscribe, rate, and review. I like their work very much. I like their insights. I don't think that they would begrudge one Brendan Lochner for going for a takedown, because at the end of the day, that is a wrestling maneuver. But they are friends of the program. They are our sister show, if you will. And I want you all to support them. So go check them out. Cheap Heat, wherever you get your podcasts, rate, review, subscribe, all that and more. They do a great job covering the world of pro wrestling. Speaking of pro wrestling, my next guest, Mark Ramundi, is a pro wrestling aficionado. And I want to keep the Contender Series discussion rolling along. I don't typically do this, but because it is so controversial and the conversation that I just had with Aaron was so passionate, let me ask Mark. Mark, would you have given Brendan a contract yesterday?
Man, you were grilling Aaron.
Yeah.
Grilling him.
Well, he came out of the gate like, oh, of course, I wouldn't have given. See, this is the problem that I had with Aaron's his thought process. He's like, I knew that he wasn't getting a contract because I know what Dana White is looking for. And I'm like, no, of course. We all know who Dana White is. We know what he's looking for. The question isn't, you know, would Dana White give him a contract? The question is, how do you feel about the reasoning, and should the man have received a contract? The reasoning being, of course, that he didn't get the contract because he went for a takedown with 10 seconds left in the fight. And then, of course, he didn't get the contract. And so I felt like it was a bit of a cop-out to say, well, I know what Dana White's going to say. That's like saying, that's like a fight being close, and you know that there are incompetent judges judging the fight, and you say, I bet that they're going to score it, and I agree with the decision because I know they're incompetent. They're going to score in favor of this guy, even though the other guy really did deserve to win the fight.
I feel like I stumbled upon a deposition here.
Yeah.
Is this a podcast, or am I being grilled by Ariel Helwani Esquire?
Yeah, that's right. So answer the question.
Brendan Lochner deserves to be in the UFC. He was the best fighter on that show last night, without a doubt. He was the best. It was a great performance. I thought he looked great. He should already be in the UFC. He shouldn't even be on Dana White's Contender Series. However.
Oh, here we go.
However, I did not blame Dana White for doing that last night, because that's not what the show is, not who deserves to be in the UFC. It's like a reality television show almost. It is who is the most entertaining and who comes up with finishes and exciting performances and highlight reel knockouts on that given night. And Brendan Lochner did not do that, unfortunately. Does he deserve to be in the UFC? Without a doubt. There's no doubt about it. He should have already been in. He shouldn't have had to go through this dog and pony show. But it is a dog and pony show, and it's Dana White's dog and pony show. They might as well just call it that, because the only people that get in are the ones who he believes will, you know, quote unquote, bring it. And that's what happened.
Okay, very interesting.
You get what I'm saying?
I guess I do.
Not, the Contender Series is not not based on merit. I feel like I missed that memo.
I feel like I missed that memo. What about Puna? Are you saying, okay, Puna went the distance?
Yeah.
Which fight did you enjoy more? Which performance did you enjoy more?
I thought both had good performances. I enjoyed the Lochner Aljo fight better.
Yeah.
But I mean,
and?
I understand. Dana White. Look, it was a damn takedown. It was a damn
takedown.
Come on,
Mark,
right,
please. Really? Are we really going to talk about this? A takedown with 10 seconds left?
I'm not saying I agree.
With 60 seconds? Listen, if it was 60 seconds left, I get it. Oh, you laid and prayed. 10 seconds.
Right.
10 seconds. We're talking about a 10-second takedown. Come on. Really?
Yeah.
10 seconds left in the fight. Was he going to knock him out? How many times is there a knockout in the last 10 seconds? It's very rare. Coincidentally, Chen Sung Jung was knocked out in the last... Come on, really? What are we saying here?
It's not a UFC fight where winning is the number one priority. It's putting on the most exciting fights, and if that is the strategy in the end.
But it was an exciting fight.
You know, takedowns don't steal rounds. That's also a myth.
Okay,
like, that's also ridiculous to think that you would do that thinking that you steal the round that way. That's not a thing. It was said for so many years on UFC broadcasts that people think that taking someone down at the end of the round steals the round. It's complete BS. It's not even true.
You're 100% right about that. It sort of feels like it's ingrained in the fighters, though, to do that sort of thing. They think in their mind that that's an exclamation point. Again, if Dana White would have said, I didn't like that fight, I don't think he's that good, I don't think he's UFC ready, whatever the case may be, listen, it's his show, he can do whatever he wants. But the fact that it was all pinned on the 10-second takedown, like, that was the deciding factor. So you're telling me, do you believe if he would have just stood there, taken more shots for the sake of taking shots, even if he's hit for the next 10 seconds, even if he doesn't land a punch, but it's just swinging wildly like it's, Leonard Garcia out there fighting again against Nam Phan or something like that, then he gets in? Is that what we're saying?
Probably.
What is that?
Probably.
That doesn't seem weird to you? That doesn't seem weird?
This is not UFC Fight Night 375 where, wins are of the utmost importance. This is the Contender Series where you have to pretty much go balls to the walls to show that you should be in the UFC. Of course he deserves to be in the UFC. It's ridiculous. He was the best fighter on that show, but the show is not that. The show is not here. Like, we're going to pick the best fighter. No, it's not that. We're going to put the best fighter in the UFC who has the craziest, most wild finish and performance. That's how it's been for the past couple of years.
But again, then I'll ask, was his performance less than Puna's? Was Puna's more impressive? It wasn't.
No.
So then how do you justify this? How do you justify any of this? Because he went for a 10-second takedown?
I cannot justify that. I guess Dana White can. But I cannot. That's the confusing part.
If they just would have went with DeCastro, who got the finish, then it would have made all the sense in the world. Okay, fine, you want finishes.
Right.
But in this case, you went with a guy who went the distance, and the fight wasn't – it was fine. It was like – the other crappy part about it is that we're even comparing Soriano and Loughnane.
Yeah.
Like the decision to take or not take Loughnane should have nothing to do with Soriano. Soriano should be in the UFC, too.
It's not a zero-sum game.
Something else, I tell you. What did you think of the new arena, Apex? Like the show, the way it looked compared to the old Tough Gym.
It looked similar. It looked cool. I mean, it was fine. I haven't been there myself in person, so I can't really give.
But how it looked on TV.
TV. I thought it looked good. I mean, I thought it was like an interesting place to watch a fight. It kind of had like a nightclubby feel to it.
Do you know what it reminds me of? Cool. It reminds me of like those. Late 1970s, 1980s, like Portland wrestling shows, Memphis wrestling, where like the guy he competes and then he goes to the back with Lorisenko and it's like right off, that's how they used to do it, like those studio wrestling shows.
By the way, like backstage in Atlanta or something.
Yeah. And I'm actually, I like that. It's kind of cool. It reminds me of that. I actually think, I think Lorisenko is like the star of the show. Like the fact that she does,
she's awesome.
The fact that she does like the ring announcing, and then she goes to the back to do an interview. That's kind of, I don't know if it's close. I haven't been there either, but that's a lot of work.
Laura was good when she first started. She was a natural, but the improvements that she's made over the last few years on Invicta, and UFC shows. I mean, she is a rising star in the industry. She's awesome.
Yeah,
she's really awesome.
I think personally, just my opinion, I think she's the best of the backstage interviews. Interviewers, I should say, especially because she has a bit of the knowledge of actually fighting. She fought for Invicta, but I think she does a great job. I think Brandon Fitzgerald and Paul Felder do a great job. I like the fact that they kept the team from last year and they work together on the UFC shows as well, so there's a chemistry there. It's fun.
What I like about Contender Series, it feels very organic. It doesn't feel as manufactured as like UFC, a regular UFC show where everything is kind of like prim and proper and overproduced almost to a point. This seems almost underproduced in a good way. Like, it seems very organic. Like, they're getting into a fight, and then they're going to, it's very informal.
Yeah. All right. I think I spent
enough time. No music, there's no entrance music. It's just they're walking out, they're going to fight.
It's raw. Mark. It's Raw, okay? That's the
Tuesday
word.
Night Raw.
Yeah. That's the word you were looking for. Let me ask you about yesterday's news that Valentina Shevchenko and Liz Carmouche will, in fact, be fighting. It was supposed to be July 20th. They called an audible on that one and moved it to the Uruguay card in August, August 10th. And so they're pulling Carmouche from the Roxanne Modafferi card and moving her to that card, the new main event, of course, for the July 20th card, or the main event that they ended up settling on is Leon Edwards versus RDA, which is a great fight for that division, the 170 division, and for, you know, for that show. It's great. No problems with that. But first I want to ask you about the decision to take a fight away from Roxanne. And, you know, this is I've talked about this in the past, bout agreements, right? Roxanne signs that bout agreement. She can't just move and take another fight, but they can do that. Do you have any problems with this?
I do in a sense. I mean, I don't like that idea that they can just break a signed agreement like that, and they do. I mean, the same way they can break a promotional agreement with a fighter. I mean, they can cut a fighter at pretty much any time. They can make that decision unilaterally, whereas the fighter cannot. The fighter can't just decide, you know what, I'm just going to leave the UFC and go fight, you know, for Bellator or Rises. They can't do that. So the UFC pretty much has unilateral control over those contracts as well as bout agreements, and it is unfortunate. I mean, it's not ideal, but the fighters have very little leverage unless they collectively bargain some more leverage for themselves.
Yeah, it is an unfortunate thing. She seems to be handling it very well and just wants to get a new opponent for that card, and I'm told that they're trying to get her a new opponent. But I have to say, if you put that aside and she seems to be at peace with it, I really like this fight. Like, I think they picked the right fight. Yeah. I know that they actually reached out to Caitlin Chookagian and offered her the fight first, and it didn't work out timing-wise for her. She's getting married in early September. I really like this fight because of the story of Liz Carmouche having a win over Valentina Shevchenko in 2010. She gave Valentina her first pro loss, and because she was a part of the first ever female fight in UFC history against Ronda Rousey. I spoke about this a little bit last week, and so I want to get your thoughts. Do you like this matchup, and do you think that Carmouche has any kind of chance against Valentina Shevchenko?
I do like it a lot, and I was actually pretty surprised when I saw that there was some criticism of that fight yesterday when it was broken by our own Brett Okamoto. I don't know what was the alternative. You know, who else did these critics want? I think that, like you said, there's a great story there. Valentina Shevchenko has only lost to two women in her entire career, Amanda Nunes and Liz Carmouche. And if you have the opportunity to do that rematch with Carmouche, it may never come again. It may never make sense again. It makes sense now. I think you absolutely have to do it. It gets Shevchenko that chance, that opportunity to get that win back over Liz. I'm sure she wanted that fight. I mean, who wouldn't, right? I mean, fighters always say, I always want to get those fights back that I lost. As far as if Carmouche has a chance against Valentina, I mean, I don't know. I listening to Paige VanZant on your show on Monday was very funny, where she called Shevchenko terrifying. And she is. I mean, she is terrifying. There's something very steely and just unique about Valentina. When you look in her eyes, there's something different there about her. I think I would pick Valentina Shevchenko over everyone in the 125-pound division, but Liz is just ultra tough. I don't think she's getting finished quickly. I think it's probably going to go the distance. Liz is a hard out for pretty much everyone, so I think it'll be a lot of it will be a grind, but I do see Shevchenko winning.
Yeah, she is something else. She might be the most dominant champion right now as far as the gap between her and the rest of the division. Somewhat reminiscent of, you know, the DJ run at 125 in the male division. And again, I would argue that she's maybe even more dominant than he was back then. UFC is back this weekend in Greenville, and it's a car, it's like one of those, you know, under the radar cards. You know, there's not a ton of, you know, big names, if you will, but I do feel like there's a lot to like there, especially for the hardcore fan. What intrigues you most about this card? Any particular fight, name, storyline?
I mean, I think the main event will be really interesting. Anytime the Korean Zombie, Chan Sung Jung, gets into the octagon, there's a potential for a fight of the year candidate. And I think Hanada Moicano is a good dance partner as well. So I mean, that'll be a good fight. I'm very interested in seeing also, speaking of the women's 125-pound division, Ariel, I'm very interested in seeing Andrea Lee against Montana De La Rosa. That's a really, really intriguing fight. Two women that the UFC wants to push. They're both marketable. They're both on winning streaks at women's 125. We could be talking about a potential challenger for Valentina Shevchenko, the aforementioned, in the future. I think there's a few really interesting fights on the card, but those are the ones that I've kind of had circled. Ashley Yoder versus Fury Kondo. I have a story about Ashley Yoder coming out on Thursday morning at ESPN.com/MMA. So please check that out if you get a chance.
Can you give us a taste, or do you not want to?
It's only a few hours away.
Oh my God! So you're going to tell us you have the story coming out, but you don't want to tell us what it's about.
Well, it's a. I don't want to give it away.
Okay, fair.
You gotta give a little tease, but it's a pretty heart wrenching story. It was a pretty rough one to talk about with her and to write as well. One of the more difficult stories that I've had to do as far as putting words on paper.
Wow. Okay. That's all I needed as far as a tease is concerned. I can't believe you didn't pick Matt Wyman. I'm all about the return of Matt Wyman. 5 years.
But he won't talk to you.
I know he won't talk to me, but it's been 5 years.
Maybe after this fight he'll talk to you.
5 years. Like, why is he coming back? Why?
Why not? Yeah, I would love to know.
I don't understand. Why? What are his motivations? Why is he doing this? And Luis Pena is still, in my opinion, he's still a very intriguing prospect. So I don't know. Matt Wyman. I never thought I'd see him back.
Yeah.
This should be the main event.
I haven't even thought about him in years.
This should be the main event. By the way, I have some breaking news. And it fits perfectly. Roxanne Modafferi did, in fact, get an opponent.
Hey.
How about that? You seem very excited about it. You don't even know who it is.
I am. Who is it?
It's happening as I'm just texting back. Any guesses? Anyone you want to guess?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's too hard. Jennifer Maia.
Okay.
Now you feel better about it.
A little battle of former Invicta fighters.
Yeah. So there you have it. Breaking news. I don't think we've ever actually broken news on this show before. And, of course.
How about that?
The show
same
is.
Same card, right? San Antonio?
San Antonio, July 20th. We're not live, so no one actually knows that. It's like shouting into a forest. But this, for
and
the record.
That's a rematch, Ariel.
It is a rematch, yes. A rematch of a fight that happened back at Invicta FC 19, September
Correct.
Of 2016. In fact, I bet that our next guest can tell us all about that. Should we bring in New York Rick now? New York Rick, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, there he is. Here. I wasn't expecting
to do
this.
And I would love the band to
sign
together.
I would love nothing more than to talk about that fight of the night at Invicta FC 19 between Roxanne Modafferi and Jennifer Maia.
Please, tell us all about it.
It was a really good fight. Five rounds. I think there was a sector of people who thought Roxanne actually had won that fight because it was so close. Jennifer Maia ended up getting the nod. But I think this is a perfect fight for kind of both of them. I'm very interested in it.
Wow, look at that insight. It's like I planned this all. We got the Invicta expert. And you're great. This is the first time we've ever broken news on this show before. Like, it actually happened. No one knows except for you.
Is it going to be breaking is the key. Like, are we going to get this out in time for it to be breaking news? I'm hoping so.
Well, how can I break it if I'm doing the show?
You can, but I've seen you do things more incredible than that in my time knowing you. But we will see what happens.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Mark, I appreciate the insight. I've never done this before. I've never asked all the panelists on the show the same question in this new era of the show. But I feel like I now have to ask. Mark, tell them how passionate it was. Tell them.
I felt like I was being grilled by Johnny Cochran on the stand.
Okay, so then I guess I'll have to ask New York Rick the same question. Do you want to stick around for it, Mark, or you want to listen to it afterwards?
Hang up. I'll listen.
You'll hang up.
What about all sports radio?
First time, long time. Yes. All right. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. You know, if you could do me a favor and hook me up with that story, I'd appreciate it too, since I'm doing this.
Oh, yeah, sure. No problem. I got your back.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate that. You're the man.
Thanks.
All right. There he is, Mark Raimondi. So this is the question that I've been asking everyone, New York Rick. Did Brendan Loughnane deserve a contract yesterday? And in particular, do you agree with the reason why he didn't receive one?
So I always, whenever questions like this inevitably come up, the word deserve is always the one that stands out, right? It depends on what we're kind of measuring here.
Can give me a straight answer here. You all have to preface it with some kind of nonsense.
Well, because you're using a term that doesn't necessarily apply to the current landscape in MMA and particularly in the UFC. Do I think Brendan Loughnane is a UFC caliber fighter? Undoubtedly. I think that he proved against a very tough opponent that he is UFC caliber, and I think Dana White actually himself even said that. Do I think that there is a consistency in the logic that Dana provided by saying he's looking for fighters that are killers or looking to finish the fight? Somewhat, because I don't think necessarily that shooting for a takedown in the last 10 seconds is not indicative of Brendan trying to finish that fight. I don't think that one singular moment really says that he wasn't trying to finish that fight. He was hitting Algeo with some incredibly strong and powerful shots. I definitely think he was trying to get him out of there. But Bill is a very tough fighter, and I think that was a difficult task ahead of him. So I don't necessarily think that the logic holds up, entirely. I think there is something to say about it, but I don't think ultimately that Brendan does not deserve or belong in the UFC. But I also think that platform, as Dana has laid it out, is a showcase for excitement because there are very few bells and whistles. The fights kind of have to stand on their own. And then under those circumstances, Dana White was not willing to give out the contract. So I don't necessarily have a problem with it because I think everybody involved understands and expects that Brendan will be in the UFC at some point. But this was not the night.
Okay. So you don't agree?
I don't agree that performance is a no-brainer to get a contract via Dana White's contender series.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, gosh. My head is hurting from all this. All right, let's move along because I can't keep talking. I just think, can I just say, because you didn't hear, you can't pin that on a takedown with 10 seconds left.
I agree with that completely. But I also don't think the rest of his performance said that you need to sign me immediately.
All right. We will agree to disagree on that one. You were at Bellator on Friday, Madison Square Garden. Chael Sonnen retired. He lost to Lyoto Machida. It was a pretty one-sided affair. And then afterwards took off the gloves, put him in the middle of the cage, said goodbye. And now we're sort of, talking about his legacy and what he's accomplished in the sport. Full disclosure, of course, he works with me on the Ariel and Bad Guy show, but I feel like I have always been pretty honest about who Chael is and what he's done, good and bad, and he's been the same. If I ask you, what is Chael Sonnen's legacy in MMA, what would you say?
Oh, boy. That's a complicated question. Ultimately, I think my memories, my interpretation of Chael Sonnen's career and how I will, remember him is that he was one of the innovators of what is the contemporary trash talk game, what, has led to the Conor McGregors and then beyond, what has led to characters like fighting on the same card Dylan Danis that night, what has, spawned that generation of trash talkers that have a few lines in their back pocket, but ultimately have enough wit to kind of come off the cuff. That is what I will remember Chael most for. Now, certainly, how close he came to defeating Anderson Silva is, something that nobody will be able to forget, that will definitely be a part of that conversation and part of that legacy. But I think because he came up short and then came up short in the rematch as well, that ultimately won't be the thing that he is most remembered for as much so as how good he was on the mic. Now, then you obviously also fold in the positive drug tests. And I think that's an unavoidable part of the conversation. But I do think that he did a good job of kind of moving beyond it and distancing himself from it, so much so that I don't think it's as big a part of the conversation as it could be. And I think that the thing that stands out the most to me is what he did on the microphone.
Although he did joke about it yesterday, I think it was yesterday or was it 2 days ago, about like the drug legacy and all that stuff. So I don't feel like he really cares whether or not that is part of his legacy. And like I said, he sort of put the blueprint out as to how to deal with this stuff. And I thought it was somewhat,
yep,
it was somewhat poetic that TJ Dillashaw broke his silence with him the day before his fight and spoke about the same thing that they both popped for EPO. And so there were these headlines that that Chael's the worst drug. I'm trying to find the tweet here, if I can find it as I'm speaking. That he's, oh, here it is. He said, not to be picky, not to be picky Kevster. What does picky Kevster mean?
He is referring to a headline by Yahoo Kevin Ioli. So he is referring specifically to Kevin Ioli and calling him Kevster.
Oh, I didn't get that. Not to be picky,
yes,
Kevster.
Yes, there was a headline written by Kevin Ioli, and in it he was called the worst drug cheat in history, in UFC history, or whatever the title was.
Oh, now I get it. Okay, not to be picky, Kevster, but I wasn't one of the worst drug cheats of my era. I was the best. I mean, how do you not love that guy?
Yeah. He has conveniently, for his legacy, been able to kind of spin that in a way that only he can. And I think it's more evidence to the fact of what I'm saying is his wit, his ability to tell stories outside of the cage, not even just with his fighting, is what I will remember him most for.
Yes, one of a kind. Still part of the team here. And really, I mean, a guy who helped bring MMA to the masses for a very long time at ESPN. It's amazing how he rebounded, because I remember when he left Fox, you know, it looked like he may never get another job in TV. And then he was picked up by ESPN. And now he's one of the few guys who's able to break barriers. You see him doing Bellator work. You see him doing UFC work. You see him doing ESPN work. Now he's omnipresent and he's doing all those, you know, those clips online and his podcast. It's amazing. Just, he's the guy's everywhere. And a few years ago when he popped for the second time, you thought that he may never, you know, get another job doing any kind of media, and he's really rebounded nicely. And I guess that's part of the legacy as well. So, you know, we wish him well. And as far as like our show is concerned on Mondays, his interviews were some of the greatest ever. And, you know, the interviews that we did on the road, some of the most memorable ones ever. And so, I will miss Chael. Like the period from when he fought Nate Marquardt, really, like when he fought Yushin Okami, post Okami, to the first Anderson Silva fight, was just incredible. Like, he was just on fire, and the stuff that he was doing in his interviews on Twitter was a pretty new medium. Just absolutely amazing stuff. That was a really fun period. It was a fun time, and I remember the weigh-ins in Oakland before UFC 117, and the heat between him and Anderson. Remember, the first, you know, like they looked away from each other. That went Anderson. What was it? I think it was, if I'm getting this correct, the press conference in San Francisco on Thursday. Anderson like looked straight at him, and he looked away. Yeah, I think that was it. And then at the
That's right. And then at the
weigh-in on Friday, Anderson looked away, and he looked straight at him. It was amazing theater. It really was. And it was heartbreaking to see the way it ended for him, but all part of his story. Want to ask you about Aaron Pico and Dylan Danis. I find it to be like, it really annoys me when I see people say that Bellator ruined Aaron Pico, and then in the same breath, they say that Dylan Danis is being protected by Bellator. And Scott Coker has been blamed, and sometimes rightfully so, for putting together too many mismatches, cupcake fights, and not testing, you know, his prospects. Like, for so long we were saying, oh, when are you going to give MVP a tough fight, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't blame him for whatever's happened to Pico, and then also blame him for Dylan Danis' second pro fight, and that he's not fighting someone tough enough for you. Like, oh, in his next fight he needs to fight a ranked guy. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. And I personally prefer the Dylan Danis route. Like, Dylan, that it should be that way. You should be fighting 10 Max Humphreys in the beginning of your career. And the way that Aaron Pico and his team have handled his career, that's the mistake. But I don't blame Scott Coker for this. How do you feel?
Yeah, I find it hard to blame Scott Coker in this regard. You know, you've presented the case very well in terms of, you know, what the two possible paths are. There's not really a middle ground there, although, you know, sometimes you can kind of luck into that. You can kind of hit what I think is a natural progression. I'll give an example. I think Israel Adesanya had a really nice, like, clean progression. It wasn't slow. It wasn't fast. But he was able to continue to kind of take those steps up. Those are more rare, and you kind of have to get lucky breaks in that regard. Ultimately, you know, you have to take it matchup by matchup. And I think in this case, it's really on Aaron Pico's management and Dylan Danis' management to decide what that path is, who these opponents that they're facing are going to be, and find it much less so at fault for faltering on the promotion. I think that is, you know, the promotion is there to offer the fights, and the management has to be the one that shepherds him in that in that direction. If they felt that this was not a fight that was good for him and he needed something to build a little bit of confidence, then they shouldn't have taken the fight. You can't just, you know, continue to throw the guy out there and hope that he's going to tough it out. So I would say much more so on the team around him than the promotion in this.
It's just amazing to me that we forget all the times we criticize Scott Coker for protecting guys. Like, you know, if you want to say that Danis is being protected, I think it's ludicrous to say that. The guy's only fought twice. But if you want to say that, fine. The guy never had an amateur fight in his career. Like, what do you want? You want him to fight ranked guys? Oh, sort of like Aaron Pico, who's now 4-3. I see the same people criticizing him for Danis and criticizing him for Pico, but for two completely different reasons. It doesn't work that way. Now, everyone has their own path. Everyone has their own career. But look what, like, you're asking him to do to Danis what you're also criticizing him for Pico's career. Makes no sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have nothing to add because I think you're right and you laid it out very well.
Do you think Pico can be saved? Do you think his career can be turned around or is it too late?
Absolutely. This is not boxing. This is not boxing. I think, you know, there's certainly been some long-term damage in terms of his confidence, right? Like, you cannot start your career in the way that he has started and feel like a world beater. You just can't. You cannot, you know, and prospects like him, if you were to build them up that way, if you were to feed them, a couple of lower-level opponents and build them up that way, there would be that confidence kind of building and brewing. There's certainly been some long-term damage done by these losses. But as far as, you know, further down the road, I definitely think this is not the end for Aaron Pico. He's way too talented, and in the moments, you know, in these fights, he tends to be winning. He tends to be dominating before it all kind of unravels, whether it be getting into sloppy striking exchanges, whether it be not being able to control the wrestling and then on the next shot getting the knee. There's always that moment where it turns, but I think, you know, it's clear that he has the tools, whether it be sticking to the stand-up or in the grappling. He's very talented in both regards. It's more about him not being able to mix it together and be a complete mixed martial artist. And that's where getting those reps against those lower tier opponents is kind of key. So I think as long as the next opponent is somebody that he is going to, you know, be able to showcase his skills and somebody that he's going to be able to get that experience in the cage without fear of it turning sour quickly, I think he'll be fine. I think ultimately he is so athletic, so talented that they'll be able to build him back up. But there's been damage done, no doubt about it.
Give him like 3, 4, 5 Max Humphreys now. Let him fight local guys on the prelims, build him up. I don't think he's done. And quite frankly, I think he's really lucky that he has Greg Jackson in his corner now. Maybe they didn't have enough time prior to this fight, but just the scene of Jackson guiding him out of the cage with his hands on his shoulders, he's got one of the best minds in the game, a great mentor, and I know Jackson is very invested in him and motivated to work with him, and motivation has been, you know, an issue for Jackson as of late, so I think he's very lucky in that regard.
Yeah, and what you saw in that fight was a very intelligent fighter and a very good fighter. You definitely did not see somebody who looked like they were overmatched. I think that's important to note, is like, what we're saying is not that Aaron Pico is going into these fights and looking like somebody who's about to get crushed. He doesn't look like a deer in headlights. He's just missing something. He's not able to put together the game in the way that he should be able to with all the tools that he has. And I think he needs more seasoning. He needs somebody like Greg Jackson to kind of help him with that. But he looks to be dominant in the moments that he is, you know, competitive in these fights. He looks to be able to execute a game plan. We saw a very wrestling heavy game plan from him, whereas in the past we've seen him off the boxing and it didn't work in his favor. So I think that everything is there. He just needs more time with Greg Jackson and that team in Albuquerque, as well as, you know, an opponent that I don't think is as dangerous as some of the ones he's been facing lately.
What's your level of interest in the re-signing of Fyodor Emelianenko? Do you care? Are there fights that still interest you with him involved?
Not particularly, because I don't think there's any stakes. There's really nothing that Fedor would be competing for at this point. Whether, you know, if there's a legend fight, you know, if Fedor versus Mirko was possible, if Mirko was coming out of retirement.
What about him versus Rampage Jackson?
I'm more interested in that fight than any other, but I'm still not that interested. For me, the Fedor chapter of MMA has closed a long time ago. There's really nothing I don't see a reason to kind of continue, honestly. So I'm out. I'm not particularly interested.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that they re-signed him because Fedor is expensive. And I just don't know. Like, I suspect that they're going to try to bring him to Japan. And I think that the Rampage fight is on the table. But I just don't. Okay, so Japan, it might work for one fight. But overall,
yeah,
Fedor is very expensive. Even at this stage of his career, he is expensive. And I would just like to see them, you know, use that money for something else. Now, maybe money isn't an issue. They're getting a ton of money from DAZN. They're getting a ton of money from Viacom. They're getting a ton of money from all these places. Okay, that's all well and good. But I just feel like the juice really isn't worth the squeeze anymore with him. And if you're going to have him fight legend fights, cool. But is that really going to pop the rating? Is that going to get you new subscribers, all that and more? I don't know. I was surprised. And when Scott was on the show, when Scott Coker was on the show not that long ago, it sounded like he was out of the Fedor business as well. And so this one really caught me off guard.
It did sound. Yeah, it did sound like that. And I was also surprised to hear that they were announcing that, because it seemed like he did leave the door open for, you know, a one-off in Russia, I believe, was the initial pitch that he said. So I am a bit surprised that they're getting back into business. But at the same time, look, I mean, there's not, outside of the UFC and Bellator, there aren't a ton of available names that are going to bring anybody in the door, let alone, you know, a small portion of the crowd. So I think Fedor is one of those names that at least gets people to perk up and pay attention. Whether the money justifies it, that I would say I doubt very much.
All right. Great stuff, my man. And good luck to your Cleveland Cavaliers Thursday night.
Thank you.
NBA draft. I'm sure it's going to work out great for them. Or you're not a fan anymore, right? Because now that they're not playing in the finals.
This is Rich coming from Ariel two-team Helwani.
What?
This is brilliant.
Two-team? Three-team?
I love hearing
my that. Guy Mike Conley, baby, coming over to the Jazz. Great time to be alive.
Three-team.
Sometimes
three-team
four.
Helwani.
Sometimes four. All you haters.
But yes, the Cavs are going to do great. They're going to get Garland, I hope, and then figure out the point guard situation. You and the Knicks will land your Canadian brethren, RJ Barrett and everything.
You see how it all works out? You know. You see how it all comes together? Canadian, Knicks, I mean, it's all just very perfect. Thank
I'm
you so much.
You.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
I was going to say, by the way, we'll talk to you next week, and that reminds me, we're actually off next week, so there's going to be a Monday show. As per usual, no Wednesday show, no reporter show, and then no Monday show on July 1st, my first non-Christmas off week, if you will, as far as Monday is concerned, in years, like 3-4 years. And then I'll be back July 3rd for a Wednesday MMA Reporters and Ariel and the Bad Guy, and then off to Las Vegas July 4th for UFC 239. Woo! A lot going on. Yeah. Good time to be alive. Bellator this weekend in London, as I said earlier. Solid card. Gegard Mousasi against Rafael Lovato Jr. Melvin Manhoef on the card as well. Aaron Chalmers. Paul Daly versus Eric Silva, the return of James Gallagher. Fabian Edwards, who's a big-time prospect as well. Charlie Ward. Mike Shipman. So a lot to like there, especially if you're a fan of European MMA. And then, as I also said, Saturday night ESPN Plus, UFC returns, debut show in Greenville, South Carolina, Hinata Moikano against Chan Sung Jung, Rob Font against John Lineker, Brian Barberina against Randy Brown. When I was in school, they told me not to say against, that I'd never get a job because I said against. That's a very Canadian thing to say. It's supposed to be against, but I say against. Montana Del Rosa against Andrea Lee. Other ones that I'm looking forward to, Kevin Aguilar against Dan Ige, Luis Pena, as I said, against Matt Wyman. And how about Deron Wynn against Eric Spicely? Spicely taking this fight on 6 days' notice. Ariane Lipsky against Molly McCann as well. So that's this Saturday on ESPN2, 4 p.m. Eastern, and then ESPN Plus at 7 p.m. Eastern. Thank you very much to Aaron Bronstetter from TSN. Appreciate his insight. Thank you very much to Mark Ramundi of ESPN. And, of course, my old pal, New York Rick, as well. Thank you very much to all of you for listening and for continuing to download, rate, subscribe, and all that stuff. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your listenership, and I appreciate you joining us on this episode of the MMA Reporters. I'll talk to you soon. Have a great week.